And our sermon text is Romans 4, 1-8. What then shall we say was gained by Abraham, our forefather according to the flesh? For if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scripture say? Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Now, to the one who works, his wages are not counted as a gift, but as his due. And to the one who does not work, but trusts him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness, just as David also speaks of the blessing of the one to whom God counts righteousness apart from works. Blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord will not count his sin. We'll be with Abraham, the patriarch, here these next few weeks as Paul goes into an extended treatment of this patriarch. In families with strong ethnic heritage, patriarchs rule, as indeed the Jews with Abraham. I grew up in Western Michigan, which is strongly Dutch in its heritage. If you ain't Dutch, you ain't much in Western Michigan. My maternal grandfather was first-generation American. Just thinking of all my uncles who served in the armed forces this over their lives, many of them now just passing one after another. My maternal grandfather was first-generation American, his father having emigrated from Holland in the latter quarter of the 19th century. My grandfather was revered in our family, where I had 10 aunts and uncles and 29 cousins. Our family parties were a lot of fun, though. Christmas, Thanksgiving, 4th of July, Labor Day were the big ones. Every Sunday night we would meet, too, at Grandma and Grandpa's house for dessert and hymn singing after Sunday evening service. Learned to sing parts there around my grandmother's piano. My grandfather would regale us with stories of his father, our patriarch, Jules Westra was his name. And none of us cousins had ever met him. We only knew him from the larger-than-life stories told about him by my grandfather. He arrived with only a few dollars, a suitcase with his earthly belongings. He made his way to the predominantly Dutch community of Grand Rapids after spending some time in Ellis Island. He had no relatives in Grand Rapids, but he knew some families that had come from his home village in Holland. Starting with nothing, he began doing odd jobs in repair. He built upon this foundation to become an accomplished carpenter and builder. Married a good Dutch girl from one of the village families. And voila, my grandfather then comes along, and my grandfather took his carpentry business and built one of the most successful contracting firms in Grand Rapids, Westra and Sons. My great-grandfather became, for all of us cousins, the prototype of what it meant to be an American. If you wanted to clinch an argument or make an unassailable point, all you had to do was invoke great-granddad Westra. Work hard like great-granddad and you'll be successful. Very simple things. Very simple. The fundamentals are simple in life, aren't they? If you want a church, there are two church planters in my family. I'm one of them. If you want a church, start one and build it like Granddad Westra. Bethel Reformed, he built Bethel Reformed Church in Grand Rapids, one of the most magnificent buildings in that city. Great-granddad rarely signed a contract. Even then, it was never longer than a page. His word was his bond. How often have you heard that? But it's fundamental, isn't it, to character, especially American character. His word was his bond. His contract was his right hand. And family first. Family first was something that he always stressed as well. All of these simple principles guided my upbringing in the Westra clan. The fount of all wisdom and knowledge, it was our patriarch, Granddad Jules Westra. Come to find out we're not alone in our family. It seems that these principles and practices characterize much of early America, too. In fact, they characterize much of the human experience, including that of Israel. For all of Israel, from their mama's knee, Abraham was the paradigm of faith, the progenitor of the nation, not only of its bloodline, but its collective soul. There was a sense of solidarity, racial and ethnic solidarity, that stemmed from Abraham. This concept of the unity of the race, both the whole human race in Adam, we'll unpack that in chapter 5, but also that of discrete ethnic races too. For all of biblical culture at this time, the race descended from the first father, the patriarch. For Israel, this was Abraham. Dr. Moose says, Abraham was revered by the Jews as their father, and his life and character were held up as models of God's ways with his people and of true piety. To cite Abraham faithfully was to clinch an argument, to seal a point in truth. Isaiah 51, verses 1 and 2 say, listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, you who seek the Lord. Look to the rock from which you were hewn and to the quarry from which you were dug. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah who bore you. For he was but one when I called him that I might bless him and multiply him. Isaiah 51, verses 1 and 2, just one sample of how Israel and the Jews revered their patriarch. Therefore, the Apostle Paul here spends all of chapter 4 appealing to Abraham as the father of faith, the beacon of belief, the model of grace in whom righteousness was explicitly imputed by faith. This has the effect of doing what invoking my great-granddad did. It clinched the argument. It sealed the point. It shut the mouths of those who contradicted what you were trying to say. Does Paul achieve his ends? Let me ask you, does Paul achieve his ends? Let's begin that journey through chapter 4 with verses 1 through 8, where Paul gives us the doctrine of imputation. That's our title today. Imputation. A big $5 theological word, but one that's crucial and important to your salvation. A lot of people on the day of judgment will long for the imputation of righteousness, of Christ's righteousness, that they do not have. But you as a Christian, having been born again into the life of God through Jesus Christ, you indeed have Christ's righteousness imputed to you. And it's a precious gift, and it shall learn to be appreciated and relished in the Christian life, that we might love God more, as we pray today, an everlasting love. Imputation. Verses 1 through 4. Humanly considered, Abraham's works counted as righteousness. Humanly speaking, Abraham's works counted as righteousness, but not before God. Verses 1 through 4, Paul makes this point. Now, from chapters 1 through 3, Paul has just concluded a sustained argument on behalf of the righteousness of God that is to be acquired by all men, Jew and Gentile. There's no difference. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, Paul says. And this righteousness of God acquired through faith in the finished work of God's Son, Jesus Christ. We have said again and again, Romans is a sustained argument for the righteousness of God. What it is, why we need it, how it is acquired, and then how we live it out after we have acquired it. Paul, being a Jew through and through, knew how his brothers after the flesh might reason from what he's just presented. Well, Paul, all of this might be true for Gentiles. They might approach God in the merit of another. Our father Abraham, however, and we are sons of Abraham, came to God in his own merit. His works were perfect and worthy before God. This is sustained through all of the Jewish literature. Abraham was perfect in all his deeds. The book of Jubilees says in chapter 23, Abraham was perfect in all his deeds before the Lord and well-pleasing in righteousness all the days of his life. The prayer of Manasseh declares, Abraham did not sin against thee. So we find this strain replete throughout the Mishnah and other Jewish literature. The Jews were cut from the same cloth as Abraham, and therefore did not need this faith of which Paul spoke. Therefore, Paul brings forward Abraham for the chastening of the Jews and the encouragement of Gentiles. Abraham does both at once, simultaneously. How does he do this? Well, Paul begins with a question. A classic approach, right? The rhetorical question. What then shall we say was gained by Abraham, our forefather according to the flesh? If Paul can demonstrate that the one with whom we share patriarchal solidarity was justified by faith, then it only stands to reason that we, his children, must be justified by that same faith. And he's proceeding to do that right now. But first he must show the bankruptcy of being justified by works, howsoever completely Abraham may have obeyed the law. Did Abraham gain the righteousness he needed in order to be justified? An important word there. Did Abraham gain? Eurekenai. It means to find or to gain or to discover. Those of you that know the history of science, the word eureka comes from this word, right? Eureka, I have found it. Archimedes, discovering the laws of buoyancy in his bath, right? Eureka. He won the gold prize from the king. Well, what did Abraham, eureka, what did he find? Did he gain anything? Did he gain the righteousness he needed in order to be justified by his works? And now Paul begins to reason on two levels. Paul reasons now through Abraham and his works, through Abraham and his faith, and he does it on two levels. He does it first on the horizontal level and the vertical level. The horizontal level, this is the level upon which men compare themselves with other men and spend 24/7 supporting their egos and their places in life, right? Their status in life by comparing themselves with others. We do this all the time, horizontally comparing. And it usually leads to the conclusion, hey, I measure up all right. Better than some, worse than others, but on the whole, pretty cool. I just want what I deserve from God, heard one man say. But Paul is also working on the vertical level. This is the level most men either avoid or are totally clueless concerning. It is the level upon which God measures man by his perfect standard. How do we fare when measured here? Now, Paul grants that when measured on the horizontal plane, comparing the patriarch Abraham with other men, he certainly excels. He has something to boast about. Abraham indeed has something to boast about on this horizontal level. The author of Hebrews says this about Abraham. By works Abraham obeyed. Now, I want you to see whether I'm citing this properly. By works Abraham obeyed when he was called out to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance, and he went out, not knowing where he was going. By works he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of that same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. By works Sarah herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man, and him as good as dead, were born descendants as many as the stars of heaven and as many as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. Now, of course, this was bragging rights for every Jew, right? Abraham like this. And, of course, if you were listening carefully and know chapter 11 of Hebrews, you know it's not by works. The author of Hebrews knew very well, by faith Abraham obeyed. By faith he went to live in the land of promise. By faith Sarah received power to conceive. But there was a counter strain in many of the sections of Judaism at this time, by which they thought he did earn his own righteousness. And this is those to whom Paul is speaking here. He has something to boast about on this horizontal level, but not before God. How about on the vertical level? Paul deftly alludes to his whole argument from chapters 1 and 2 when he says, but not before God. Okay? So this is what I mean by a sustained argument. Paul figures you have been paying attention for verses 1 from chapters 1 through 3, where he's already established that Abraham does not have anything to brag about before God. However, we've already seen that all men, Jew and Gentile, are judged by the same perfect standard, God's Torah, and are found wanting. All men fall short of the glory of God. Since this, then, is a sustained argument for righteousness, we're to remember the entire flow of Paul's thought. All he has to do is remind us in this summary fashion, but not before God. In fact, we have textual warrant for Abraham being justified by faith himself, not by his works. For what does the scripture say, Paul says? Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. Abraham put his faith in God, not his works before God. Abraham put his faith in God, and it was counted. The Greek word there is to count or to reckon. To count or to reckon. And this faith then was counted or reckoned to him as righteousness. This is the first occurrence in the text that we read from the Old Testament today, Genesis 15, verse 6. The first occurrence of to believe in Scripture. Always an important juncture when you have the first mention of a concept or belief, and here it is, faith. Genesis 15, 6 is the first use of faith for justification in the Bible. So Paul's citation of it and use of it here is apt. Secondly, to account or credit a thing. Note with me, very important here. This is the heart and soul of imputation. To account or credit a thing. A frequent use of this term in Hebrew and in Greek, because it's important to your salvation, because without the righteousness of Christ also being a part of your salvation, then you stand before him cleansed, but still not righteous. Both of these components are necessary, not only the cleansing from sin, but also the crediting of Christ's righteousness to you. In 2 Samuel chapter 19, we see this word account or credit when Shimei, the son of Gera, remember he insulted David on his way out of town when he was fleeing from his son Absalom. Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as David returns now, as he was about to cross the Jordan, and said to the king, "Let not my lord hold me guilty, or remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem." That term, "hold me guilty," is the same word used here. To account or credit. Don't account me as guilty, O king, for insulting you as you left town. And in Psalm 106, recounting indeed the story of Phinehas and how he slew the two who were indeed in bed with each other, Phinehas stood up and intervened, and the plague was stayed. And that was counted to him as righteousness, the psalmist says, from generation to generation forever. So we see this term counted or credited often in the scriptures, in the Old Testament as well. O.P. Robertson says, to account to him a righteousness that does not inherently belong to him. That's the idea of imputation. To account to him a righteousness that does not inherently belong to him. That's us as well. For righteousness to be imputed to us is to account a righteousness that's not ours natively. Luther called the righteousness of Christ that is given to us, that is counted put on our register as our very own is an alien righteousness, one that is not known to us natively, one that is not ours by our inheriting Adam's nature. And you need this, brother and sister. We need this righteousness. It is a precious part of our salvation. Not often preached, not often taught, is it? But utterly requisite for your redemption and salvation. Now, this righteousness and its reckoning or its accounting to your account must now be seen through the work of Christ, as it could only be foreshadowed in the Old Testament by Abraham, only foreshadowed by Abraham. But it was there in seed form in Abraham, nevertheless, and Paul is recalling this. This is what we mean by progressive revelation. Indeed, the righteousness of Christ accounted to Abraham long before he saw Christ. He saw him by faith, did he not? In you shall all the nations be blessed. And indeed we have we not been blessed in this seed of Abraham, this Christ? But his work now completes what was promised to Abraham. Our righteousness now seen through the work of Christ. And Paul now returns then for contrast to the original premise most men and the works righteousness the Jewish brothers hold dear, good works earn good merits. That is, well, he had something to boast about, right? Good works earn good merit. To the one who works, Paul says, his wages are not counted as a gift, but as his due. Well, duh, we all know this, right? Unless you're government is inflating your currency such that they rob you even as you earn. But this basic principle we all understand. To the one who works, his wages are not counted as a gift, but as his due. Yes. This is language from the marketplace, and it holds true. If God counted works on the vertical level as men count them on the horizontal level, then indeed Abraham had something about which to boast. Now, something of the chagrin inherent in the response of the Jews, of course, for whom this is all registering as something that has contradicted all they've thought and taught for their lies, something of the chagrin of this principle of grace and reckoning faith as righteousness is felt also by the older son in the parable of the prodigal son, for example. Remember, the older son was angry, refused to go into the party. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, "Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends." I would consider that a favor, actually, not giving him an old goat. "But when this son of yours came, who had devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him." Something of that same chagrin is inherent, Paul sees in the audience that he is writing to as well. They've worked all these years and now you're telling us it's by faith? Paul is saying, no, this principle was established long ago in the very establishment of your line. It's often the initial protest of those we hope to evangelize, isn't it? It's counterintuitive. It's the natural response of the natural man. You mean my works don't mean a thing? Accounting righteousness before God? Not if you understand God. This is why we need the scriptures. This is why we need the Bible, why we need special revelation. To show his utter and perfect standard, what he requires is utter and complete perfection in our righteousness. The beauty of holiness it is then. Consequently, when we see it in its proper perspective, how beautiful holiness is, in part because it's perfect, glistening, beautiful, radiant, attractive, will be all throughout eternity. And that righteousness is now yours in Christ because it's his. But the natural man, of course, to him it's counterintuitive and he rejects it initially until God opens his eyes. Because Paul has another accounting, if you will, another reckoning for righteousness that's not on the horizontal level, but the vertical. And he treats of that in point two, verses 5-8. Let's look to those verses then. Imputation. You're never supposed to preach on these big words in contemporary churches. Did you know that in the church growth movement? This is death in the church growth movement. We preach on propitiation. Can you pronounce that? Is that a word? Propitiation. Thank you. Yes. I was teasing, of course. Kazaius is over there shaking his head. Oh, pastor. Imputation is another one of those words you're never supposed to preach on. But where is your soul if you don't? If you don't understand and embrace Christ's righteousness that is freely given to you, freely credited to your accounts. Imputation. Biblically considered, point two, Abraham's faith counted as righteousness, as witnessed as well by David. And a good biblical definition is given us then in verse 5. The principle of imputation is here clearly and simply enunciated. To the one who does not work, but believes. To the one who does not work, but believes. In him who justifies the ungodly, his faith is counted as righteousness. That's what you need for your salvation. If you're going to get into heaven, you need this. You need Christ's righteousness imputed to you. And here in this simple definition in verse 5, here the act, object, and obtainment of imputation are seen. Let's break these down. Stay with me. The act, object, and obtainment of imputation are seen here in this verse. The act of imputation, this is the placing of complete trust in the one offered in the gospel as the object. The placing of complete trust in this one who's offered in the gospel. That's all. Simple enough a child can understand. Children understand trust, don't they? I remember sitting John up on top of the refrigerator when he was a small boy. Come on, daddy's arms, right? Boom! Loved to jump from the refrigerator into daddy's arms. Trusted indeed that daddy would catch him. Complete trust. Imputation involves the complete trust in the one offered in the gospel as the object, not your placing of trust in the working of one's own work to save. That is a false, misplaced trust if you are trusting your own works to save you. Then there is the object of imputation. The object of imputation, this is the one who saves, that is Jesus Christ. And his work of propitiation and reconciliation. Trust is placed completely, wholly, and solely upon Christ, and not in the works one does as an object of righteousness. You'll go to hell if you're trusting your works to save you. Jonathan Edwards says, God, in the act of justification, has no regard to anything in the person justified, as godliness or any goodness in him. In truth, he beholds him only as an ungodly creature, so that this supposed godliness cannot be the ground of his justification. God must see Christ's righteousness in you, if indeed you are to be saved. What a rebuke it is then to the man who preens himself over his good works. You want to see a lost man? Look at the man who preens himself on his own good works and trusts in them to save himself. John Chrysostom, back in the 5th century, reflects on this. He says, for a person who had no works to be justified by faith was nothing unlikely. But for a person richly adorned with good deeds, not to be made just from these, but from faith, this is the thing to cause wonder. And to set the power of faith in a strong light, doesn't it? Sets the power of faith in a strong light for a man richly adorned with works to be saved by faith. Do we have to be saved by faith? Well, then we also see the obtainment of imputation. The obtainment. Not only the act and the object, but the obtainment of imputation. This is the essential status of being reckoned or counted as righteous. The sine qua non of salvation, that without which there is no salvation. Unless you are accounted or credited as righteous, you don't get into heaven. Oh, Pastor, this is Memorial Day. Let's get out of here fast, okay? I'm not sure what this is all about, but I got places to be, people to see. On that day, however, when you are stood up before the bar of God's justice, you say, "What was that again, Pastor? What was that again about justification? I'm ready to listen now." It'll be too late by then. You need to listen now in the day of faith, while indeed there is yet a day of salvation. You need the sine qua non of salvation to be reckoned or counted as righteous. Hear it and embrace it, obtain it by faith. Now. This then is that underrated, underreported doctrine that plays such an integral part in your salvation, that is, imputation. And how crucial is this act of God's free grace? Note with me a few things about it as we ponder it, because there are other churches that teach other things about justification, that is, being made just and righteous before God. We say, for example, that it is forensic in nature, that is, legal. It has to do with your legal standing before God, your righteous standing before God. Roman Catholicism says it's not forensic and that it is not imputed to you, but rather infused. Righteousness is infused into you. Now that means you're not fully justified until you are finally fully infused with righteousness at the end of time, before the judgment seat of God. And nobody knows then. Nobody knows when they're if they're really a saint or not, because their lives aren't over yet and they haven't been judged before God when righteousness is infused. So there's a deep contrast here. This is why there's saints in the Catholic Church. We all consider ourselves believers as saints, do we not? But Catholics don't know if they're saints or not until they get to the judgment seat of God. Unless we can document, you know, there's been some miracles, for example, in Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa will probably be a saint here. And the Catholic Church will be able to definitively say, okay, she was so good, so righteous. She did miracles and have all the criteria that they tick through. And then finally, you know, a couple decades from now, they'll say, okay, well, Mother Teresa was a saint. And we can pretty much surely say that she was. Because of infused righteousness, the difference between imputation, forensic righteousness, and infused righteousness. That's one of the differences, you practical differences. Your theology has consequences in your life. The Protestant reformers say, no, no, no. How did you get it so wrong? It's a simple forensic legal declaration. And that may seem, don't talk to me, courts are boring. You know, legal proceedings are boring. Lawyers are boring. Unless, of course, you're standing trial for your life, right? In a capital case, then it's not so boring. Imputation is forensic in nature. John Murray says, justification is always forensic. It is not the forming of the character or framing of the conduct. That's infused righteousness. He's talking about Roman Catholicism there. Justification is not the forming of the character or framing of the conduct. We call that sanctification. It's not that we ignore that, but we say, no, that comes, these are separate. It comes later, sanctification does. Justification, however, is not the forming of the character or framing of the conduct, but only the recognition and declaration of the status that belongs to that person. Your legal status is always forensic. It is also objective. That is, it's outside the sinner. It's not infused into us. It's outside of us. It's objective. It is imputed righteousness. Nevertheless, very important. Just because you can't feel warm and fuzzy about it doesn't mean it's not important. And just because it doesn't give you a spiritual zing doesn't mean it's not important. It is objective and outside the sinner. And it is also a once-for-all act, not a process over time. In contrast, once again, to the Roman Catholic view of infused righteousness. It is a once-for-all act, not a process over time. Just as a verdict is rendered in a courtroom once and it stands, so our justification, the imputation of Christ's righteousness, is rendered once from the bar of God's justice and stands. To clinch his argument, Paul then cites David in our psalm today. Blessed. See, the psalmist understands the idea of the blessing, the makarioi of justification and of imputation. Blessed indeed, and blessed are you, brothers and sisters, for having Christ's righteousness imputed to you. And I hope you love God more for it, understanding it, and after today as well. But blessed are those whose lawless deeds are forgiven and whose sins are covered. Blessed is the man against whom the Lord will not count, there's our word, impute, will not count his sin. And here the negative side of imputation is seen. Sin is counted, reckoned to the one outside of Christ. That's the obverse, then, of this principle. And we'll look at that especially in chapter 5 of Romans 2. But it is foreseen by David in the Old Testament. How crucial this is. And I want you to not only understand more clearly in days to come this idea of imputation. You understand now more and more reconciliation, propitiation. And you're all going to be theologians here by the time we're done, aren't we? Especially you dads. You dads, as you teach your kids these things around the table. And they'll be able to have a handle on these things, too, as they explore with their friends and relatives and neighbors the grace and the beauty of God's holiness and his righteousness. Because it is crucial to your understanding of salvation. And it's not boring. Remember screening. 12 Angry Men. You remember that movie, 12 Angry Men? An old black and white film from the 50s, but a jury retires to consider the evidence and render a verdict in a capital case. A lot of great stars in there, too. Henry Fonda is the foreman of the jury. And it's a hot summer day in August, and there's a baseball game that one of the guys is listening to. It's raining outside. Just a dull, hot, muggy day in New York. And they just want to get this over with. It's obvious this guy's guilty. And so they take a straw vote, 11-1. Oh, who's the guy? Who's the one who's keeping us from getting out of here? The guy's obviously guilty, and of course it's Henry Fonda. Slowly, through the course of the movie, one by one, as they examine the evidence, they all change their vote. And they go back out to render their verdict, and here's this poor Puerto Rican kid, right, who thinks he's going to get the chair. He's sitting there in tears, practically, in the stand as he stands up at the table. And they render the verdict not guilty. How do you think this kid reacts, right? With great relief, in tears. It's a beautiful scene. 12 Angry Men, an excellent movie, Academy Award-winning movie. But how do you think that kid felt, right? Pretty important to him, wasn't it? Well, there's going to be a day like that for you, too, in the judgment bar of God. And that's precisely what imputation then does for you. It imputes the perfect righteousness of God that is utterly of Christ, that is utterly requisite on that day. And it is given to you by faith, for your acceptance of it by faith, not by works. So that is how crucial it will be for you in days to come. Well, let us consider then the price which was paid for that righteousness for you. As we come then to the supper of the Lord, the body and blood of Christ in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.